The North Carolina Reading Service presents the following program for our audience of blind and print-impaired listeners. I am John Federson, and I'm here to read the Indie Week to you. The edition this week, September the 13th, 2023. And my folder is jam-packed with articles from the print and the online edition. And so I'll skip all of my amusing commentary and just get to them, shall I? And I'll begin from an article published 2 days ago about the Department of Environmental Quality fighting back against a ruling in favor of that Wake Stone mine near Umstead Park. Administrative law judge Donald van der Vaart ignored evidence, committed logical errors, and misinterpreted state law when he ruled in favor of Wake Stone, which plans to expand its Triangle Quarry to abut Umstead State Park in Raleigh. Those are among the allegations included in documents filed last week by the North Carolina Department of Environmental Quality, which is appealing van der Vaart's decision to Wake Superior Court. DEQ also asked the court to temporarily halt construction on the expansion until the dispute is resolved. Their Division of Energy, Mineral, and Land Resources, DEMLR, denied the company's mining application in 2022, nearly 2 years after it was filed. Brian Wren, then the director, based his decision on the significant adverse effect on the purposes of Umstead Park due to noise, visual, and traffic impacts. It was only the fourth time DEMLR had denied a mining permit in more than 50 years. This is one of seven conditions on which a mining permit can be legally denied. Wake Stone appealed Wren's decision to the Office of the Administrative Hearings, which is the venue for this type of case. The seven-day trial overseen by Judge van der Vaart, himself a controversial former DEQ secretary with an acrimonious history with that agency, occurred earlier this year. Last month, he issued a scathing ruling against DEQ, writing, quote, "It would be difficult to imagine a set of facts more demonstrative of an arbitrary and capricious government action," unquote. He ordered the state to grant the permit to Wake Stone by September 12th and pay Wake Stone's attorney and witness fees as well as other court-related costs. In its appeal, DEQ rebutted the ruling in equally damning terms. Throughout the 24-page filing, agency attorneys cited several examples they say demonstrate van der Vaart made, quote, "incorrect conclusions of law and acted arbitrarily and capriciously." For example, in the summer of 2020, while DEMLR was evaluating the application, the national engineering firm WSP solicited Wake Stone as a potential client. WSP told Wake Stone it could evaluate the proposed mine's noise impacts on the park with the assurance that, quote, "the proposed criteria would be selected to allow Wake Stone to continue operation without overbearing restrictions," court filings read. Van der Vaart allegedly failed to account for that bias by WSP, wrote the DEQ. Wake Stone paid WSP $130,000 to develop an acoustical study protocol, which DEQ approved after suggesting several changes. The results of that study showed that a sound wall could reduce the noise level from the mine. However, van der Vaart erred in determining the sound wall would mitigate mine noise entering the park. Instead, DEQ wrote that evidence showed the sound wall would reduce noise at a private residence that is near but outside the park and outside the scope of the case. Now, this timeline of this tract of owned by the RDU Airport Authority is now given in this article, and I'm going to skip over that. You can go to indieweek.com and read that timeline, which starts in 2017 and ends in this appeal. Next heading, mine would spoil the view for park goers. DEQ also wrote, Vandeweyde allegedly overlooked or ignored the area of Olmsted Park next to the proposed quarry as a dedicated natural preserve that merits further protection under the Nature Preserves Act. According to court filings, the Olmsted Park superintendent testified this designation, quote, gives some additional protections to an area that's considered to be more sensitive, more needed in protection, and has some type of natural importance. Also at issue was the mine's disruption of the natural views at the park. Parts of the Yellow Dot Trail run along the boundary between the park and proposed mine, which would be visible to people using the trail. In his remarks on the potential visual impacts of the mine, Brian Wren referred to, quote, worn recreational trails along the park boundary. Although he did not call those trails by the colloquial name, there is no question he was referring to the Yellow Dot Trail, say the court filings. Vandeweyde also reasoned that because 60% of the Yellow Dot Trail is not on park property, which DEQ also disputes, quote, the use of that portion of the trail is trespassing and can't be included as a reason to deny the permit. But park officials have not deemed the Yellow Dot Trail off limits. The superintendent further testifies, quote, he is aware of the uses by the public in the area of the proposed quarry, and those uses are allowed. Indeed, those uses have been ongoing for such duration that the public has worn a path through the area and given it a common name, the Yellow Dot Trail. Superintendent also testifies, quote, there's no enforceable rule that says you have to stay on trails. While there are signs in the park asking visitors to stay on designated hiking trails, they're not near that yellow dot. Finally, Vandeweyde ruled that Wren didn't have the legal authority to deny the permit because that power had not been delegated to him by the DEQ secretary. DEQ disagreed, but more importantly, pointed out the pretzel logic. Wake Stone's entire case rested on Wren's denial of the permit. If Wren wasn't authorized to make a determination, it would be impossible for him to make a decision, let alone one that was arbitrary and capricious, as Vandeweyde had written. Earlier this year, Administrative Judge, Law Judge John Evans, who is DEQ's former Chief Deputy Secretary under Vandeweyde, used the same premise to toss out a historic $260,000 fine against Bottomley Properties because the wrong DEQ employee signed the paperwork assessing the penalty. However, in that case, lawyers for Bottomley Properties challenged the employee's authority in court. Wake Stone's attorneys never did so, and the question was never broached at trial. The DEQ did not appeal Evans's ruling. Instead, Vandeweyde independently requested information about the signing authority and conducted a hearing on the issue 2 months after the trial. Vandeweyde served as DEQ secretary under then-Governor Pat McCrory, a Republican. During his tenure, he earned a reputation for his anti-regulatory stances. In 2016, after Donald Trump was elected president, Vandeweyde wrote a letter which read like a job application, asking Trump to gut the federal EPA. He was reportedly in line for the number two EPA position, but was ultimately passed over. In late 2016, as Democrat Roy Cooper was preparing to ascend to Governor, Vandeweyde, knowing he'd soon be out of a job, demoted himself and Chief Deputy John Evans to a mid-level position in the Division of Air Quality. He lasted in that position a year. Then, DEQ Secretary Michael Regan suspended Vandeweyde and Evans for co-writing an opinion piece in a science journal advocating for relaxed air quality regulations. Both men resigned from the agency in late 2017. In 2019, Vandeweyde was nominated to the powerful Environmental Management Commission, which has authority over DEQ, by Senate Pro Tem Phil Berger. 2 years later, he was appointed as Chief Administrative Law Judge by conservative Supreme Court Justice Paul Newby. Vandeweyde then appointed Evans as a fellow Administrative Law Judge. Another short environmental article from IndyWeek, published on the 12th of September, yesterday. Durham housing developer allegedly violates Clean Water Act, jeopardizing Falls Lake. Falls Lake is going through some things, writes Lisa Sorg. Fertilizer is running off from farm fields, entering tributaries. Toxic compounds known as PFAS, whose sources remain a mystery, have been detected at and near the dam. And when it rains, clay muck flows from large, clear-cut lots, suffocating nearby streams that feed the lake. Although the lake is the primary drinking water supply for 500,000 people in Raleigh, Garner, Knightdale, Roseville, Wake Forest, Wendell, and Zebulon, land clearing on the Durham County side of the watershed is a major contributor to the pollution. And one development in particular, Sweetbriar, a subdivision of 616 homes and townhomes being built by Clayton Properties / Mungo Homes, is central to a lawsuit filed in federal court last week. Sound Rivers, a nonprofit environmental advocacy group citing Durham County and state inspection records, as well as its own water quality sampling, alleged Clayton Mungo has violated the Clean Water Act more than 20 times since last year. Clay and dirt, collectively known as sediment, has been documented leaving the 200-plus acre property and entering Martin Branch and Hurricane Creek, which flank the site. Both waterways feed Lick Creek, a direct tributary to Falls Lake. Mungo Homes is a division of Clayton Properties, which is based in Maryville, Tennessee. The company operates in 18 states. Sound Rivers is represented by the Southern Environmental Law Center. Mungo Homes officials did not respond to emails seeking comment. Sedimentation in waterways is a serious problem. There are rules governing how much dirt can leave a development site and enter waterways, because bacteria can hitchhike on the sediment particles entering the drinking water supply. The excess sediment can make it more difficult for utilities to treat and filter drinking water. And when too much dirt enters a waterway, it can kill aquatic life and ruin or impair its habitat. Similar incidents have occurred in Chatham County at the massive VinFast site. Jonathan McNeil, Durham County Erosion Control Supervisor, repeatedly warned Mungo it was out of compliance with its permit and asked the company take corrective action. Last February, McNeil sent an email to Michael O'Sullivan, the company's land development manager, alerting him to, quote, repetitive, substantial issues found on site. These included open stream crossings with no ground cover, muck on slopes leading to the stream. I took 68 pictures of stuff that should not be happening. McNeil sent similar noncompliance notices in January of 23, as well as April, September, and October of last year. There are state standards for sediment in waterways measured in nephelometric turbidity units, or NTUs. The higher the number, the cloudier the water, indicating a lot of dirt is present. For most rivers and streams that feed drinking water supplies, the state's maximum level is 50 NTUs. The court filings read, since November 2022, every time that Sound Rivers has conducted turbidity sampling at Martin Branch, it has documented exceedances of the North Carolina turbidity standard. Just 2 weeks ago, on August 31st, the turbidity level was more than 1,100 NTU. Sound Rivers attributed the incident and several others to runoff from Sweetbriar. In addition, Sound Rivers documented exceedances of the state turbidity standard in Hurricane Creek 4 times in 3 months, also the result of runoff from the site, according to court filings. Sound Rivers is petitioning the court to find Clayton Mungo is violating the Clean Water Act and to penalize the company up to $65,000 per day per violation, the legally allowable amount. In addition, Sound Rivers asks the court to require the company, quote, immediately cease its ongoing and continuing violations and to remove from affected waters any sediment for which it is responsible. All right, continuing some articles now from Durham, specifically, at home with the matadors, writes Matt Hartman. This is a long article related to the upcoming election from Durham's housing crisis and SCAD, S-C-A-D. Jerry McLean's house is the one on Fayetteville Street with the skeletons hanging in effigy and a sign reading, Black Seniors Hung Out to Dry and Die. He's been accumulating protest signs for years since the city began negotiating to buy part of McLean's property in 2013. After construction on the intersection of Fayetteville Street and Riddle Road started in 2019, the city realized it needed more of McLean's land than expected. Negotiations failed. The skeletons came sometime after that. McLean's case was on the agenda for the August 21st Durham City Council meeting, but it got little attention. The crowd that had packed the council chambers was there for a different debate about development, equity, and change, SCAD. Simplifying codes for affordable development. The proposed amendments to Durham's Unified Development Ordinance, UDO, the collected zoning regulations that determine what can be built and where in the city, has become Durham's most explosive political issue. Shortly after the meeting began and quickly devolved into accusatory mudslinging, SCAD's applicant, the Raleigh-based developer Jim Anthony, requested a 90-day delay, pushing that vote until November. It was a tacit acknowledgement that SCAD had become too controversial for election season. SCAD first came before the council in March, but this latest delay spurred Mayor Elaine O'Neill to suggest a different kind of task force that could draw on nearby universities for objective analysis. She said, "I think that's part of the missing discourse. There is not an objective voice." This week, that task force is supposed to present a plan on how to proceed. Durham is quite literally being remade. You don't have to believe in the housing theory of everything, the idea that rising property costs exacerbate issues ranging from income inequality to climate change, to see how the council's development decisions are shaping the city's future. Even at their best, these debates are split into binaries. Affordable housing activists versus developers, NIMBYs versus YIMBYs, that are inadequate for the task. But the confusion and vitriol of that August meeting show just how poorly equipped Durham is to navigate questions of its future in its current political state. Poor black neighborhoods have allied with wealthier white homeowners against accelerating construction, while some of Durham's progressives and business-friendly moderates have joined forces with local urbanist developers in the hopes of making the most of the city's limited powers. And all are caught in a stranglehold by the General Assembly. The vast majority of voters are trying to make sense of it all. Tenants are especially trying to pay their ever-increasing rent. Nearly everyone in the debate agrees on two things. Rising housing costs are creating a crisis in Durham, and the city's zoning regulations should be overhauled. The statistics paint a stark picture of the problem's scale. Out of roughly 120,000 households in Durham, nearly 40,000, that's about a third, can't afford their current living situation. The Durham Housing Authority, long starved of resources by the federal government, has a 3,500-person wait list for one of the 1,700 units that DHA controls, and an 8,000-person wait list for the housing vouchers tenants can use on the private market, according to DataWorks NC. Nonprofit affordable housing developers are attempting to fill the gap, but they're a drop in the bucket. Durham's largest nonprofit home builder, Habitat for Humanity, built just 17 homes last year. Each costs $170,000, meaning that if Durham donated its entire 2024 city budget to Habitat, there would still be more than 35,000 housing-burdened people. Private developers provide the vast majority of affordable housing in the United States, so the only solution is to use the law to regulate more affordable housing. But North Carolina does not give local governments the powers that other cities around the country use. Rent control is illegal in privately owned apartments, with a few important exceptions, as is mandating that private developers provide affordable housing. Progressive taxes are an obvious source to boost revenues that could fund projects, but the state constitution prevents cities from instituting them. Local minimum wage laws are forbidden too, so there's no direct route to boosting flagging incomes. And tenants don't have the right to withhold rent when their apartments aren't up to code unless they obtain a court order. But cities can create zoning codes. By limiting what can be built where, codes shape the economics of development. Done right, they can weigh the scale and tilt projects in certain directions. By only allowing houses less than 1,200 square feet in specific areas, for instance, zoning regulations can prevent new McMansion developments. And by creatively writing regulations, the city can provide incentives that entice developers to build affordable housing, say by letting them build taller than they could otherwise, if they voluntarily agree to set some percentage of the units aside for low-income residents. But those strategies must be precisely calibrated to current economic conditions to work, and Durham's UDO was written 20 years ago. Growing frustrated with the situation, several local developers, builders, architects, and other practitioners began the process that gave birth to SCAD. On a drive through Old West Durham in mid-August, developer Aaron Lubeck pointed to a former church for sale next to Loco Pops and Coco Cinnamon. A large, empty parking lot sits between it and Hillsboro Road. Because the current UDO requires buildings to have a certain amount of parking spots, the lot couldn't be developed separately from the church, Lubeck explains. You're on a corner that already has two of the four corners with great little businesses, he says. This would be a great parcel to build something, whether it's housing or commercial space or whatever, but it's locked. Because of such restrictions, Lubeck says the market for local affordable housing builders is non-existent today. He says the only thing that's getting built is 100% out-of-town money, 100% big projects that are political and require lawyers and compliance officers and the kind of things nobody local could do. Taking advantage of a Durham process that allows private citizens to propose amendments to this UDO for a fee of $4,000, SCAD's authors put together a list of changes that would support the small-scale projects that larger national developers don't bother with. They focused on the lots remaining around Durham's urban core that are too small, weird, or complicated to have been built already. A proponent of the new urbanist movement that advocates for walkable cities with residential and commercial spaces intermixed, Lubeck was particularly interested in the way the UDO's minutiae, buffers, setbacks, water runoff standards, and the like, create dead car-centric space. Lubeck says buildings have to be too far apart, with too much parking. Driveway requirements mean they can't position houses in the most rational way on some lots. Neighborhood corner stores aren't feasible because of rules preventing commercial development in residential areas. And he says, there are all these opportunities to build relatively short urbanism, and that includes office space, housing, restaurants, and allows that kind of organic messiness that people love about Durham, but we've truly legislated out of existence. We have a lot of sprawl repair to do and a lot of infill on that front, and that would be transformative. The only thing that's getting built is 100% out-of-town money. SCAD even put a 20,000-square-foot maximum on some provisions, a limit Lubeck says was specifically chosen to prevent dollar stores from using them. These small projects are technically possible now, but they require developers to get approval for special permits and rezonings. Because these approvals require studies, site plans, drawings, and other services before they're voted on, and the lawyers, engineers, and other specialists often attend the various hearings, Lubick says developers have substantial costs before a vote that could still end in rejection. He estimates an average cost of $50,000 for projects impacted by SCAD, but he says $150,000 isn't uncommon. The risk is too great for smaller developers, meaning making it more likely the city gets uglier, more expensive projects from large national and international investors. While many of SCAD's 130 proposed UDO changes are small tweaks, like determining how close small stoops can be to the street and which yard in strangely shaped lots counts as the rear yard, there are also significant shifts. It would eliminate regulations requiring a minimum amount of parking spots for any new development. Any planned developments with more than 100 housing units would also have to have set aside space for civic or commercial purposes, pointing toward walkable developments. And SCAD would allow faith-based institutions to develop housing projects on their land, a provision Lubick says would be the most impactful, given the vast amount of land that they own. For many residents in the majority black neighborhoods, already experiencing rapid gentrification, Lubick's dream sounds more like a nightmare that will make housing more expensive, not less. City Council member and mayoral candidate Didriana Freeman says their argument is simple. Look around. How's that worked over the past 15 years? She asks. SCAD's most controversial provision has compounded that skepticism. PATH, Progressing Affordably Toward Housing, would alter the city's affordable housing density bonuses. Those are the carrots used to entice builders to guarantee cheaper housing. The amendments would increase the percentage of units that have to be made affordable from 15 to 25%. But reduce the length of time they have to remain affordable. From the current 30-year requirement, it would drop to just 5 years for rentals. For sale units would revert to market rate immediately after their original sale. Bonita Green, president of the Interneighborhood Council, INC, and a city council candidate, wrote in a March email to the council, "That does so little to address Durham's problem. It is shocking, given how advocates emphasize this benefit in presentations." Disclosure, the columnist says, Green and I both serve as DataWorks NC board members. Lubick argues that even the reduced time frames are better than what we have now, but that has done little to convince skeptics. Green says there's no oversight, so they're creating problems for others. It's intentional as well by these developers because they're trying to push these people out because they want the land. Instead of relaxing standards, an approach that Inc. has chastised as trickle-down housing, critics like Green want to see the city take a more aggressive approach to developers. That means restricting what can be built unless substantial affordable housing concessions are made, since zoning is the only real leverage the city has. Planning Commissioner, City Council candidate, and SCAD opponent Nate Baker says, real estate is about deal-making. The other side writes books called Art of the Deal, and they want our side to think we have to accept the first deal that comes to us on the table. The working-class black community of Bragtown is a case in point. After the Bragtown Community Association effectively defeated a proposed 900-home development with only 20 affordable units, a new developer arrived and offered 325 affordable units instead. Ultimately, Green's goal is to ensure that marginalized communities benefit from whatever development happens, which is why she objects when the SCAD opposition is characterized as NIMBYs who simply don't want new projects. That's not true, she says. People don't mind building. It's the way it's done. You are pushing out our voices. We don't have a say-so in this, and we don't like the way that you're building. Jim Anthony's role as the amendment's figurehead has not helped SCAD's case. Notoriously right-wing, Anthony told Inc., that, quote, gentrification is necessary to erase the blight, according to an INC report on SCAD. He said at an August council meeting, proving his ignorance of Durham public opinion, I don't think there's anyone who's ever looked at our projects and would say this was a mistake or that damaged anybody in this community. Given Anthony's role, many Durham progressives are wondering why left-wing politicians are backing SCAD. Why choose Anthony over poor neighborhoods? But SCAD's supporters don't disagree about the problem of gentrification. The pro-SCAD council bloc have all opposed PATH's affordability periods. They back SCAD in general because they come to the opposite strategic conclusion when they see the impact of rich newcomers moving to Durham. More development, not less, is the only way to prevent the worst ills of that reality, they say. Picture a typical run-down Durham mill house that could be sold today for $200,000 or $300,000. SCAD's authors hope to make it possible to replace that one house with four new ones, which might go for $400,000 or $500,000 each. That's a clear example of gentrification and an incentive for developers to displace more residents. But SCAD's backers are more worried about the alternative. If we don't build those four houses, the argument goes, the original mill house will still be flipped or torn down, except an $800,000 or $900,000 house will replace it. And the three households who would have built the additional houses on that lot will do the same somewhere else in the neighborhood. Councilmember Javiera Caballero, who is running for election, says they're going to make their money either way. They're going to put those big blocky things you all hate, those oversized crazy houses that everyone complains about, they're going to build that, or they're going to build more creative stuff. Councilmember Jillian Johnson says, obviously, a $350,000 townhome is insane, but that's where we are now. It's not about choosing between a utopian village and this developer's proposal. We're choosing between North Raleigh and the developer's proposal. Precisely because the people moving to Durham, part of the fourth fastest growing region in the country, tend to be wealthier, they're able to bid up the price on whatever of housing already exists. Councilmember Mark Anthony Middleton says, the African-American community has taken to champion preserving some neighborhoods, not recognizing the spillover effect, as I call it. If a wealthy person has to move to our area, it's not based on whether we build a house or not. That was the impact even with the bungalows in Southside, an affordable housing development in the historically black neighborhood just outside of downtown. An NC State University researcher found, despite controls limiting the sale of houses to low-income residents, the project's beneficiaries were more likely to be white and rich than the neighborhood's existing residents. One couple's parents paid off their cars before they filled out the program application to ensure they would qualify. Accordingly, proponents of the supply-side strategy argue the only viable option that can have an impact at scale is to build enough housing that vacancies increase and prices begin to fall. Some national data backs them up. New York writer Eric Levitz reports that places with the most new construction saw rents rise less than they did elsewhere. In places where the supply grew by more than 10%, rents even fell. Though pushing back against projects in the hopes of more concessions might lead to better outcomes in cases like Bragg Town, Johnson says it can also make things worse. After tense arguments with both the Walltown Community Association and the normally affable former mayor, Steve Shewell, over the paucity of affordable housing and its plan to redevelop Northgate Mall, for example, new owner Northwood Raven withdrew its proposal and replaced it another, with no housing at all. The city council still has a chance to weigh in when that project comes up for a rezoning request, but state law prevents it from explicitly requesting affordable housing as a condition for granting a zoning change. All they can do is say no and hope the developer comes back with a better offer. There's one policy question that cuts across SCAD support and turns the debate into a confusing ideological muddle: the role of home ownership. Moderate, entrepreneurial-minded SCAD backers like mayoral candidate Leo Williams and fervently anti-SCAD neighborhood organizers like Bonita Green share the goal of creating home ownership opportunities, as do many of the home builders who wrote the amendments. Green says everything is moving toward rentals. That's the only way these banks make their money. If you're not paying your rent, they can kick you out and charge a higher rent. And that's problematic because people aren't able to build wealth. Increasing the required affordability periods in PATH is essential to shrinking the racial wealth gap, Green and her allies say, because spurring black ownership is the goal. But the flip side is that affordability covenants cap how much wealth those houses can earn. Someone who buys a house with a 30-year affordable covenant and sells it 10 years later doesn't get to sell it for market rate, meaning their wealth doesn't grow at the same rate as the rest of the city's homeowners. Cameron Smith, executive director of East Durham's Communities in Partnership, says, "Why can we not have the ability to build wealth like white people do?" Arguing there must be a both/and strategy to balance the number of affordable houses available while allowing their owners to profit from them, Smith unwittingly echoes the arguments Williams makes in favor of SCAD, asking, "Who are we to get in the way of people building their wealth? You built your wealth this way. Why are you trying to block someone else?" But home ownership has also been a driver of inequality. Though SCAD's opponents compare the supply-side argument to Ronald Reagan's trickle-down economics, it was the white homeowners who launched the Reagan Revolution in order to protect their property investment. With Durham's median home value growing from roughly $186,000 in 2015 to $400,000 today, Durham homeowners might have as much a financial stake in the status quo as developers do in increasing construction. Opposition to development in places like Bragtown may be understandable as a justified fear of gentrification, but there are plenty of SCAD critics whose interests lie in wealthy white neighborhoods. Discussing the same Hillsborough Road intersection Lubeck saw as ripe for beautiful urban messiness, Tom Miller only saw an imposition on homeowners. The former planning commissioner and lawyer says, "When I was a little boy, this was a dirt street and those were houses," pointing to the single-family home that back up to the now commercial street. Miller laments how close SCAD would bring buildings to the existing houses. He says, "We create houses that are not desirable as residences, and we cause neighborhood decay. Dense living, if it's too dense, in my opinion, works against the welfare of the body politic." There's one group in particular that follows along with dense cities, whose existence is too volatile for Miller's comfort: tenants. He said, "I was on the planning commission for 7.5 years. I don't think I ever remember a tenants group coming in. I don't want more people in that unstable situation." SCAD opponent D.D. Rana Freeman tried another tactic to give tenants stability in 2021 when she proposed a tenants' bill of rights. in conjunction with the new, now defunct Bull City Tenants Union, but that project stalled out. The city attorney's office ruled out most of the union's more ambitious demands, and the rest, Freeman says, would likely just lead landlords to raise their rents. Quote, the tenant's Bill of Rights could be shifted into just a landlord agreement. They could voluntarily sign on to be a good landlord in the city of Durham with a stamp, but that would be as far as it would go until our General Assembly acknowledges that our tenants should have rights. But tenants bear the brunt of the housing crisis. They make up nearly half of Durham households, and almost 46.9% of them are housing burdened, compared to just 17.5% of owners. The progressives backing SCAD like Johnson and Caballero conclude the best option available is using development powers to shift market conditions in a way that makes renting more affordable, even if it angers homeowners. After all, the evidence for the supply-side approach success is lower rents, not home prices. That stance separates progressives from SCAD allies like Williams as much as it does SCAD's opponents. But there's another kind of SCAD critic. Baker, most likely the first person to be endorsed by both the moderate Durham Committee on the Affairs of Black People and the Democratic Socialists of America, similarly argues for a vision of housing that is not based on the accumulation of wealth, though he says we must also close that racial wealth gap. The columnist says, I am a member of DSA, but played no role in the decision to endorse Baker. Anyway, Baker says, I tend to view affordable housing, especially in an exploitative capitalist system, as a utility. It's a need we will always have, a utility like water pipes or sewer pipes. That thinking is why his main complaint about SCAD is not that it builds too much, but that it builds too little. Baker's goals sound similar to Lubeck's in writing SCAD, and Baker admits he has sympathy for small developers trying to build interesting projects. The goal, he says, is to make it easy to build good things and hard to build bad things. But he argues that the way SCAD allows neighborhoods to mix homes and commercial developments makes it possible to build single-family homes in new parts of the city, which other developers would abuse to increase sprawl. Hashing out the strange combination of decades-long visions and the small technical details isn't easy, but the public debate over SCAD is clearly broken. While critics argue that a developer-controlled process is inherently unequal and the authors never seriously considered their input, proponents point to the extensive public engagement process SCAD has undergone. The initial public comment period lasted from April to December, says Lubeck, and included about 70 public meetings with dozens of civic groups and hundreds of participants. There was also input from city staff and public hearings with the Joint City Council, the Joint City-County Planning Committee, the Planning Commission, and now two meetings with City Council. Williams said in August, it almost feels as though we're trying to deny by delaying. I have no issue with the substance of this document because that's what I was looking forward to discussing tonight, the substance. But we have yet to get to that because the process has been obstructed. The claim is familiar from developers and their allies who often complain about long public review times where small groups of homeowners can continually delay projects. But the activists say it's the only way for ordinary people to influence the city's major development decisions. Green says all the agencies in the city have this thing like, we don't need to talk to the community. You don't need to be involved. We make the decisions. For Baker, there's a way to solve both issues at once. Rather than wait for developers to propose a project to consider a rezoning, create small area plans for key areas of the city. By proactively getting community input, building neighborhood-specific plans, and preemptively rezoning that land, to encourage the kind of development the city wants in threatened areas, City Council could gain additional leverage for affordable housing while solving the genuine impediments that local developers face. Baker uses a project in Old North Durham as an example. A developer plans to demolish 25 market-rate but affordable rental units and replace them with 33 for-sale units, five of which will be guaranteed to be affordable for 30 years. But that still means 20 households will lose affordable rents. Baker says, we have the power through zoning regulations to prevent that kind of thing, but only by proactively rezoning parcels to account for their specific context. Caballero says the risk is giving neighborhoods too much power will allow wealthy white areas of the city to dominate proceedings at the expense of everyone else. She says there's a difference between input and control, and quite frankly, neighborhood control has a lot of loaded meaning in the South of all places. Small area planning is also labor intensive. It couldn't be done for the whole city, at least not anytime soon. Planning for the rest of Durham means writing an entirely new UDO. Conveniently, that process is just about to begin, unless the ongoing SCAD debate interferes with it. The council should officially adopt Durham's new comprehensive plan this year, then create a new UDO to implement it. But given the confusion and furor over SCAD, there's reason for pessimism about the city's ability to manage the process. Baker says you've got to trust the entity that is shepherding through major changes. It was clear from that August council meeting and public accusations of corruption that such trust simply doesn't exist currently. With SCAD now due for a vote in the middle of the council's lame duck period after the election, but before the new mayor and council members take office, it's anyone's guess whether things get better or worse. What happens to all the fragile coalitions when the electoral energy is gone? Maybe Jerry McLean's Odyssey provides a clue. After the SCAD hearing abruptly ended, the council had to vote on whether or not to use its eminent domain powers on his property. It was a 6-1 vote in favor, with Freeman dissenting. I'll have time to read another article by Lisa Sorg. This one released on September 8th. Wake County lost 11,000 acres of trees over the past decade. On the northern edge of downtown Raleigh, Capitol Boulevard is a parched and treeless hellscape where the sun wilts all who dare to cut through its parking lots. Newbern Avenue, east of Wake Med toward Knightdale, is an endless step of pavement where people waiting for the number 15 bus crowd under mangy crepe myrtles, seeking relief from the heat. Now visit Forest, formerly Cameron Park, a historic neighborhood near North Carolina State. The oaks are old, their crowns are wide, and at summer's peak, their shade drops the air temperature by about 5 degrees. These disparities and the loss of 11,120 acres of Wake County's tree cover were detailed in a land cover analysis and tree canopy assessment, which was published on Tuesday. The county had hired a consultant to measure and identify the changes in landscape from 2010 to 2020. During that decade, when the county grew at more than twice the North Carolina rate, it had to make room for all over 1 million people who wanted to live inside its borders. Consequently, the assessment reads, the county is experiencing a conversion of open spaces, natural areas, and agricultural land into built environments at a similarly rapid rate. In other words, to carve out space, real estate developers had to cut trees. More than two-thirds are deciduous, meaning they lose their leaves in the fall and winter. The other third are conifers, pines. Each year they benefit the environment and public health by removing 11 tons of pollutants from the air, absorbing 414,000 tons of carbon dioxide, and intercepting 8 billion gallons of stormwater. While most of Wake County's census block groups lost tree canopy, about 3% each year overall, that deficit was not equally distributed. Data shows that underserved communities like those along New Bern Avenue in East Raleigh already tend to have fewer trees and more concrete. These census tracts contain, on average, 6% less tree canopy cover and 10% more impervious surface buildings, parking lots, streets that do not absorb water. Without trees to remove air pollution and shade their homes, residents of these urban heat islands are beset by environmental and public health burdens, poor air quality, higher risk of heat-related illness, higher energy bills, and even the assessment noted damage to roads and homes because of thermal expansion and contraction. In Raleigh, tree loss was especially acute in northeastern and southeastern parts of the city, where growth and development are widespread. Half the entire city lacks a tree canopy. To offset these losses, the assessment recommends planting trees. The consultants identified more than 2.8 million individual sites. More than half of them were suitable for large growing trees. Nearly 370,000 sites were suitable for medium growing, and another close to 1 million sites were well suited for small growing varieties. The assessment also advised planting trees wherever possible in the vulnerable neighborhoods based on a composite score of 10 factors, such as air quality, rates of asthma, social equity, heat islands, and mental health. These potential planting areas were then prioritized based on that composite vulnerability index. The assessment found more than 23,000 acres could be planted in areas designated as very high or high priority. This figure equals 161,000 planting areas. Planting opportunities were also present in areas with very low, low, and moderate vulnerability, 250,000 planting areas, equivalent to close to 60,000 acres. In areas outside the state capital, Morrisville, with its strip malls and parking lots, has the least tree canopy, just 34% of its 6,000 acres. And some of the most environmentally sensitive parts of Wake County also were partially denuded. Far west, near the Chatham County line and within the Jordan Lake watershed, there, rapid housing and population growth continued, combined to decrease the canopy by 15% between 2010 to 2020. The loss in the Jordan watershed is notable and troubling. Trees help mitigate flooding and filter pollutants, such as fertilizer, that could degrade water quality in the lake, which is a drinking water supply for more than 1 million people in the region and its tributaries. And finally, in this article, more data from this assessment, and it's a little bullet list. Of the existing trees that are still here, 50% are in good or very good condition, 30% rated fair, and the rest are in poor or critical condition. Countywide, tree canopy comprises 54% of the land cover. That's almost 300,000 acres. Vegetation, like shrubs and grasses, make up 23%. Impervious surface, paved or built areas, cover nearly 15% of the entire county, 81,000 acres. A similar proportion of the county, 23,000 acres, is classified as bare soil. Could be vacant lots, construction sites, agricultural fields, baseball infields. And open water, like the lakes, like Crabtree Falls, Jordan, and Johnson, make up 3.5% of the county, or almost 19,000 acres. I will not have time to finish this edition of Indie Week, except to begin an article from August about the eyes of teenagers, the Duffer Brothers. And Hannah Kaufman has written, at September 8th, the Museum of Durham History opens Stranger Times. And it begins one afternoon at Jordan High School in September 2021. Michelle Needham could have sworn she was in the middle of a zombie apocalypse. Needham, curator at the Museum of Durham History, and a mother of two Jordan students, was dropping something off at the school's office when she noticed a few high schoolers coming out from behind a building for their lunch period. In-person learning had just started back up, but things were as strange as ever, says Needham. They were all in masks and came out very slowly. I think it was their lunch period. They sat by themselves, and then they went straight to their phones and ate their lunch. It was just so non-teen. They all sat separately, and it was so quiet and surreal. That moment stuck out to Needham like a particularly unsettling thriller you can't shake off. But it's not just any thriller. It reminded her of Stranger Things, the Duffer Brothers sci-fi TV show that was strongly inspired by their childhood in Durham and as their time as students at Jordan High School. Suddenly, the two things, COVID-19 and Stranger Things, were inextricably linked in Needham's mind. She pitched an idea to the MODH director, and an exhibit was born. Stranger Times opened on September 8th at the MODH, exploring the Duffer Brothers' childhood in Durham and foray into filmmaking, as well as the similarities between the show and aspects of the pandemic, paying particular attention to the latter experience from a teenager's point of view. The exhibit will share students' narratives through a variety of media, including video, audio, and written records. The museum staff and students have brainstormed ways to utilize the building's small space to the fullest, even extending some of the exhibit outside under a gazebo and using walls to separate part of the exhibit. The beginning of the quarantine in 2020 may not feel that long ago, but history doesn't have to be ancient to be valuable, says Patrick Mucklow, executive director of the museum. A lot of times people have a misconception, he says, that history is all just old and ancient from decades, hundreds of years past, but there is a lot of history being made right now, and recent history is also important. Well, here comes my music to tell me I can't read any more of this article. John Federson for the Indie Week, as telling you that this broadcast will be available as a podcast after our initial playing on Friday afternoon. So I will be back, I believe, next to read the next issue of Indie Week from the North Carolina Reading Service, ncreadingservice.org. Bye-bye.